Blog Talk Radio.
Depot with the general workers union. am, yet that I'll never change a thing. Well, they won't fight, and they're not working.
Hello there. Is this Jenna
Hi,
on the phone?
Hi, guys. Thank you for
being connected. We are connected. Oh, my goodness.
For the... We have phone. We have Blog Talk Radio.
I know. We have, for the listeners right now who will be listening to this later, guarantee you they're not listening to it live at the moment because it's Oscar moment. It's Oscar time. But we had, Jenna and I had a heck of a time getting connected on Blog Talk Radio. So we've had to kind of postpone it for the last 20 minutes. And we're so excited that we finally are now on the same line and we can get started. So
we are.
Kind of intro us.
It all this clear.
Yeah, so going to intro us, this is Christina McMorris. I'm the author of Letters from Home and Bridge of Scarlet Leaves, which is coming out in just a couple days. And I'm speaking to someone who I already consider a good friend, even though we have never got to speak in person before because we've been cyber friends for quite some time. And that is the amazing Jenna Blum, who is the New York Times and international bestseller of Those Who Save Us and The Storm Chasers. So that's who we are. Jenna, tell us a little bit, or tell them, I guess I know all about you, a little bit about your two novels.
Gosh, I don't even know how to live up to my own press here. First of all, I'm just so happy to get a chance to talk to you, Christina. It is like an oddity of our internet age that we can be such great friends, even though we haven't met yet, but we will be meeting at the Tucson Book Festival and having a Skype party with one lucky book club who's going to meet us and another World War II era author, Sarah McCoy. So it's going to be kind of a wild fest. And I guess that didn't answer your question at all, which I'm like totally thankful for doing. But my
That's
first
okay.
book, Those Who Save Us, is a World War II era novel about a German woman, a non-Jewish German woman, who saves herself and her little daughter during the war in Germany by becoming the mistress of an SS officer. And the second book, The Storm Chasers, is about a sister trying to protect her brother who's bipolar, and that's obviously a more contemporary novel since it also features storm chasing. Mm-hmm. And so often readers ask me, you know, how did you leap from one thing to the other? And one of my novel students once said, well, tell them you went from stormtroopers to storm chasers, which, you know, I was like,
exactly.
but really both books are about characters who survive these terrible traumas and how they try to rebuild their lives afterwards. So that's me. That's kind of fun writer I am.
Yeah. Yeah, and which I loved. I mean, you know, Those Who Save Us is obviously the first book I read from you, and I just fell in love with that book. It was just so captivating. And I remember one of the things that I've actually always been curious about, and then I'll go into a little bit about about how I found a similarity when I wrote my second book, and that is, you know, there's a good portion of the book of Those Who Save Us who is kind of that's kind of in a dark spot, you know, that that there's a lot of rawness to it. And I remember thinking, wow, she had to live in that world writing this book for quite some time. So what's your thought on that?
I did go through what one of my readers called method writing when I was working on a novel. It was the culmination of 10 years' worth of research, on and off. I mean, it wasn't like I was chained to the desk all the time, but 10 years' worth of research, including interviewing Holocaust survivors and reading cheery things like Rise and Fall of the Third Reich and the Buchenwald Report. And I was watching German movies, baking everything that appears in the novel, which is no small feat because half the novel set in a bakery. And really, it was a complete immersion experience, and you would think it would have been a really grim existence because so much of Those Who Save Us is, as you said, raw, which I think is a pretty polite term, and there's a lot of kind of nasty, explicit stuff in it that I imagine happened to a lot of women. But the experience of writing it for me was actually cathartic because I'd been carrying these scenes around in my head since I was a very little girl. I was the daughter of a part German mom and a Jewish dad and grew up with an intense awareness of the Holocaust. So to be able to put some of this stuff down on paper that I'd been carrying around was sort of a relief.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was interesting because I wrote, when I wrote my second book, which is The Bridge of Scarlet Leaves, and that one, I'll give a quick recap just about what the story is and then explain how where I found that similarity. And that is, you know this well because you've already read an advanced copy, and that is the basic story is that you've got a violinist named Maddie Kern who secretly elopes with her Japanese-American boyfriend the night before Pearl Harbor is bombed. And then when his family is interned at a relocation camp, she dares to follow and becomes one of the few non-Japanese spouses that lives voluntarily in the camps. And then from there, her husband wants to prove his allegiance to America and joins the Military Intelligence Service, which was a secret branch of the U.S. Army responsible for code-breaking and interrogating against Japan. So that, of course, is a very quick gist of a long book. But what I found in that was, you know, so much every day writing so much conflict, but also there are parts of the book, as you know, that there is a brother involved that's Maddie's brother, TJ, and he becomes a POW in a Japanese war camp. And I do remember the days that I had to write that where I'm not used to reading, having to do the research about Holocaust, and even though I write World War II stories. And so in this case, that was where I every day having to research and watch documentaries and memoirs for weeks about those POW camps. And I remember some days just being in tears reading the research, you know, reading the accounts of what these guys went through and the lack of humanity and compassion, and then trying to, you know, to put something on paper when I just felt like I wanted to close my computer and go do something happy instead. And I imagine that, you know, I remember thinking this must be what it's like a bit to be like one of those thriller writers that writes about serial killers and stuff. It's a very dark place to live for an extended period of time. So
it is. And imagine, I mean, you have a family. At the time when I was writing Those Who Save Us, I had a family and still have, mercifully, a family of friends. And you know they have to be a really good set of friends to endure me talking about Nazis for 3 years while I was writing the book, because that was pretty much my only conversational fodder was, you know, gosh, you know, I have these Nazi characters, they did this last night and they did that last night, you know, so the fact that these people are still my friends is really amazing.
Yeah, and one thing that we are talking about actually at the Tucson Festival, which I'm really excited about, so I'll mention that too as far as dates go, in case people are around. We, Jen and I, will be on a panel together about historical fiction, and then we'll also be on separate panels and keeping us pretty busy for 2 days, March 10th and 11th, the Saturday and Sunday in at the University of Arizona campus. One of the things I think we're going to touch on when we're there as well is some of the crazy things that we have done in the name of research. And I would love to hear more of yours because I know some of them, which I think are fully entertaining. But so tell us what some of the things are.
Yeah, definitely. Because of my method writing, I I think probably the oddest thing, at least to me, that I did was to bake everything that appeared in Those Who Save Us, which resulted in me trying to make a Christmas Stollen, which is like a candied bread. And I swore I would not go to bed until I had finished making the Stradamp thing, and I'm not a good baker, and I don't know why I chose to set the book in a bakery, but I'm not a good baker, and it took me like 3 days to get this bread to rise enough so that I could bake it, and there was a lot of swearing, you know, while I was wearing my little German clothes I wore when I was writing the book. I mean, it was total lunacy time, but the good news about the bread was that it lasted like 6 months, like a fruitcake. So that to me was kind of wacky. I went to Germany 4 times when I was working on the novel with my mom, who wanted to see where her side of the family had come from. She was born in this country, but, you know, had been told that her relatives had emigrated from this tiny farm town. And so the first time we went there, the idea for Those Who Save Us was born, and the other 3 times were for me to collect atmospheric details. And given the fact that neither my mom or I speaks German, and that I can't drive a stick shift, so that she had to drive 8,000 miles an hour on the Autobahn, you know, and close to us drinking little bottles of schnapps because we were so terrified that she was going to kill us. I guess this qualifies as some of the fun research things that writers get to do for their books. And it seems to me that you've done some pretty interesting research yourself, kind of, you know, hair-raising in that way.
Yeah, that's right. One of the things that we talked about on email before was about when I went on the B-17 ride, and it was amazing, and, you know, I always kind of joke about the fact that it's so relaxing and wondrous, and the view is unbelievable, and it's only, you get to enjoy every moment because you're not being shot at, you know, and you know that you get to land, you know, safely, at least nobody's trying to take you down, and that was, it was an incredible experience, and I was definitely the token female of the group, which I always think they must be looking at me like, why is she here exactly, but
yeah,
it was amazing.
The second book that I wrote, The Storm Chasers, I researched for 6 years by going to tornado chasing with a professional storm chase company called Tempest Tours from Arlington, Texas. Right. And I followed them in my own vehicle, followed the guides in the white van as they took their clients out to get them up close and personal with big weather. And I was lucky enough to be teamed up with another chick chaser, as we call ourselves, Marcia Perez, who's this great photographer architect out of Dallas. But I was really conscious of the fact that we were girls in the boy world. And that was part of what made it fun and made it sort of titillating in a way. I am amazed that you have gone up in a little tiny plane, because I'm afraid to do that in general. And just to everybody who is listening, when you have the privilege of reading Chris's book, I think you're really going to enjoy it. And now you know how she got all of her details so right, because she lived them.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, one of my characters, you know, is a tail gunner, so that was on a B-17, and that's why I really wanted to do that. But one thing that I was disappointed when you get on there, you know, the tail gun section and most of those planes, they are restored from, you know, from 1940s, and so they're not safe to sit back there anymore. And so we got like a little peek back there, but we aren't allowed to sit in there, which is probably for good reason. I think, you know, they probably have to put a parachute on us if we want to sit back there. But one of the things I'm so excited to share with you, because it happened just a couple hours ago. I just got home, you know, about an hour ago or so from an event this afternoon. This goes on the tail end of as far as research goes. I interviewed 7 World War II Japanese American vets for my story, and 6 of them were with the military intelligence service, so it was directly involved with the story. Today, since I'm in Portland, Oregon, they had a very special luncheon that was awarding the Congressional Gold Medal locally to all of the Japanese American vets from World War II. And they had done that in November in D.C. from Obama. And we then, they did a local one throughout the states that would honor the gentleman who are getting this, because a lot of them can't travel anymore. You know, we're looking at their late 80s, early 90s. And so they did that locally today, and I was invited to come. And it was remarkable, and being able to be there in an entire room full of these families of vets and the veterans themselves, being honored finally 70 years later. And one of the, even Tuskegee Airmen, the only surviving one from Oregon, was there as well. So it was a really pretty surreal moment, you know, to bring, as you know, bringing something from the page, a reverse order in a way, you know, back to reality.
The book becomes life.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of goes back and forth. And, you know, it definitely hit home for me, like you, very much in that, you know, both, I think both of our ancestries have been tied into our pages. And with me, I'm half Japanese. My dad is from Kyoto originally. So I think that just, you know, means so much more to both of us, I'm sure.
Yeah, it really does. I think in the first novel, I got to pay homage to my dad's side of the family, the Jewish side of the family, and to like a quarter of my mom's side, the German side. And then with the second novel, I was able to tap into the Norwegian part of my heritage, which is also on my mom's side of the family. So I think it's always a joy to me to encode family tradition and the thoughts that I've had about my warring ancestry, if you will, into my novels. But to speak to what you were saying, too, I always think it's so amazing the places that our research takes us when we're writing novels. I've met so many incredible people and had all these amazing experiences I would not have had if I hadn't been working on these books. So it's just a joy for me to be able to give this back to readers, both in book form and then sometimes on social media. If people are following me on my insane adventures while I'm researching, they can live vicariously that way, too.
Yeah. Absolutely. So here's something that I'm curious to ask you about, because there is something that I thought of you too when I was writing the second book, because in this one is the first time I had to incorporate foreign words to the extent that, you know, it wasn't just one small scene and having some German language instead. You know, I had kind of Japanese woven through in and out, and wondering how much to use and how much not to use. And in yours, I know it was from the viewpoint than of a German woman. So even though it's written in English, and I know I remember looking at yours and thinking, okay, so how did these other books do it when you kind of weave in foreign words as well? So how did you find that balance there with yours?
Well, I'm afraid I'm a very poor role model, because as I said a few minutes ago, I don't speak German. And so I was relying pretty much solely on a German dictionary for words that I thought were organic to the novel. I tried really hard not to put in stuff that's potentially confusing to readers. So I'm not going to shrapnel my whole book with German words. But if a woman works in a bakery, then she's going to make Brötchen, which are sort of like little wolves, but there's no direct translation. So any word that there wasn't a direct translation for, I would put into the novel in italics to signify to the reader that it was German. And I would hope that the reader would pick up what the word meant by osmosis, by context, from the words around it, from the context of the sentence, in the same way that when I was a little kid, a lot of my vocabulary words were picked up from the sheer volume of reading that I did and picking things up from what was around the difficult words. And I have since been told by many native-born Germans, not that the balance of the amount of words that I put in the novel is off, but that actually it's pretty apparent that I don't speak German.
Oh, that's funny.
I think that, you know, I got some stuff wrong. And I remember books are so strenuously edited before they get out to the public. So they are copy-read, and then they're proofread, and I read both novels aloud and, like, backwards, standing on my head to try and catch errors. But my poor copy editors, for those who save us, wrote to me during this process and said, you know, basically we're just two Jewish schmucks with a German dictionary, and if you can, you know, try and find a German friend to read this, that would be great. At the time, I have no native German friends, and I had a dear friend who spoke fluent German who read the novel and said, yeah, this passes muster, but there are a lot of native-born Germans who beg to disagree with him. So best advice I can give is, you know, if there's a word that doesn't really have a substitute and adds a flavor, an atmosphere of a culture to your foreign-born novel, then you should definitely chuck that in there, but then try and find somebody who is native-born to read it and make sure you're doing it right so you won't get angry reader email.
Right. You know, yeah, we're always scared of those emails, isn't it? When you see when you get someone that says, "I was in Chicago, you know, in 1941," you think, "Oh boy, what did they find?"
I know exactly. And I mean, I think for like, you know, a 300-plus page book, and those who say this is 400-plus, you're bound to make a couple of mistakes because everybody is human. But I do feel awfully bad when I make a mistake because it pops the reader out of the fictional world, and it's like taking a pin and puncturing that dream. And that is my fault. And so when I get those emails, unlike some other emails that say, you know, shame on you, this book is sexually graphic, well, I think, oh, well, you know, that's your opinion. But if somebody corrects me on a mistake, I really do hang my head and apologize quite humbly and say, I'm sorry I popped you out of the fictional dream. I hope you'll keep reading.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So here's the flip side, though. How do you feel about it? Because I know I've encountered the same situation. I'm sure, gosh, just about every author who, well, probably just about every author, unless you make up fantasy, has faced this before, where you have, you know, an email that someone is sending you that's trying to correct you on something that is actually right. You know.
I love that. What a great question.
I've faced that a few times, and I think, okay, how can I handle this diplomatically? So how have you handled that? I'd love to hear that.
Well, I'm a Libra, so I like to pretend at least that I'm something of a diplomat, although what seems diplomatic to me probably really isn't. I think there are rare instances in which I think it's acceptable for an author to respond to a review on Amazon, for instance, or on other places. And most of the time, I think, you know, 99.9% of the time, a reader is entitled to his or her opinion about a book. And I, even if I disagree strenuously, I will grit my teeth and say, well, I think my book is the best thing ever, and you're just so silly. But, you know, I'm not really allowed to say that. To be an author is to willingly put yourself in the stocks and let people throw things at you, whether it's roses or tomatoes. But if a reader says something that is not true, for instance, somebody said about one of my novels, you know, Jenna Blum has clearly never lived in Minnesota because blah, blah, blah. And actually, I lived in Minnesota for 5 years. My family's from Minnesota. Right. I'm very proud of my Minnesota connection. At that point, I did respond to the review and to the reader in email and just say, I'm sorry, you must not have read my website because it states really clearly I lived in Minnesota from blah, blah, blah. And I am sorry that you didn't like this portion of the book, but I feel that I need to correct your misapprehension. And if you couldn't continue reading this book, I hope you'll take a chance on the next. Because you never know what triggers people are responding to when they come after you with hammer and tongs and misinformation. It's probably something that was in their past, and I wouldn't go there, as they say. But if somebody says something that's just wrong, I feel then, okay, I am allowed to correct that respectfully and then, you know, go my merry way.
Right. Yeah.
How do you handle it?
Funny. Well, I've got a couple of them before, and you know, I think I had one that was more of just an opinion. She felt that, you know, the store, the department store they would have gone to was different in Chicago than, you know, at the time they would have gone there rather than one in New York. But it wasn't a right or wrong. It was just kind of one that was one that they, you know, would have been more normal for them to go to. And so that was one of those ones where I just appreciated her input, you know, and would pass it along.
Yeah.
Because, again, you and I both know from the writer's side, it's not, you know, once we kind of sign off on that contract, it's not necessarily up to us, you know. And even if I really do want a correction after it's printed, you know, I can pass that along. And the only thing I can do is request it. And you know, my editor and the production will decide if they feel it warrants a correction because they're very expensive to make at that point. But when it has, you know, when it has come to one that, you know, I think it happened maybe twice that I received an email that basically tried to correct me on something that was correct, you know, that it was right in the book. And I, of course, my first thought is never, you know, defensiveness. It's, oh my gosh, what did I get wrong? Because I've put so much heart and soul into it and cared like you have about doing justice to what these people went through. And that means getting it right to me. So even the minor details, you know, it's been, because it's like you get one little thing wrong that has nothing to do with maybe the war, but somehow that discredits in a lot of people's minds and even my own, the care that you put in to make sure their story is told the way it was, because that's where the heroism comes from and what they did. And so I immediately think, oh my gosh, did I do that wrong? You know, and I look it up in the book right away to make sure. And I go, no, I did that right. I think they just misread it. And I think sometimes people skim quite a bit or just happen to misread it. And like you said, they bring their own, you know, information and their own past and history into it. And so in those cases, I think I mean from the bottom of my heart, I'll email them and say, thank you so much for bringing it to my attention, because I care a lot about being accurate. And if I got it wrong, I would want to know, and I would want to pass it along and hopefully get that corrected. In this case, you know, this was, and I, again, it was very genuine. I said, I was concerned about one of these issues, which is why my copy editor, myself, and the proofreader all double-checked and made sure this is right. And here's a website where we got our sources from. And I passed it along.
Oh, yeah.
And it was,
that's probably very useful to people who care that much, and a lot of readers really do, as they should. I mean, I always take it as the ultimate compliment when a reader enters into the fictional world so much that he or she believes the characters I created are real and that their circumstances are real and is so involved in what I've written that they take the time not only to read the book, but then to put the book on pause to write to me and say, hey, you did this right or you did this wrong. I actually have like a glaring error in Those Who Save Us that one of the characters mentions Israel in 1939 when Israel did not actually exist. So I've had many people in Israel and elsewhere point that out to me. And, you know, my face is totally red, and I appreciate the reader input. I think that one thing that might interest readers who think that an author is God to her book is how little say an author has in the book once you've turned it over to the publisher. I mean, we invent the characters, and we research their stories, and we invent their stories. Once you hand it over, we have very little say on anything from the cover to the typesetting. So people have said indignantly, can you please not change this terrible error in your book? It's just embarrassing. And I would say, well, once a book is typeset and it's 400 and something pages long, it's so cost prohibitive to change it that maybe you will just, you know, grant me and my publisher some slack, and I'm terribly sorry. But, you know, we do care deeply, and I really appreciate readers, even the readers who write to me about intangibles. Like if they're upset about an emotional situation in either book or say, you got this wrong or how dare you or shame on you. I mean, I had one reader write to me and say, I left your book in a wastebasket in a hotel room in Vienna because I was so disgusted by it. And, you know, I take that as a compliment, that to arouse such a strong emotional reaction means in many ways that I've done my job.
Yeah. That's true. I definitely heard from other authors that feel the same, that they would rather have someone have an emotional response, whether it be good or bad, than a meh. You know, it was okay, whatever, forgettable, and but they will always remember that book for sure. And you know, I think that what we're creating is art. I mean, in a very different sense than paintings or whatnot, but you know that we get to really explain our thoughts and our feelings on it than leaving it for so much interpretation. But still, I think I'm sure you'll agree with this. What I've definitely learned through this process of becoming a writer is that half of what I think the reader experiences has nothing to do with us. It has nothing to do with the words on that page. It is half of it is their own experience. And the other half is what we're giving them on the page. And you combine those two things, and that is what creates the emotional response, whether they love it or hate it, whether it's the best book they've ever read in their entire lives, or you know, or it's not worthy of a one star because they thought that they'd only give it one star for the fact that it had a beautiful cover.
Right,
and I think you can get such extremes, and how does that happen when clearly, you know, an author maybe can put coherent sentences together. And I think that really is so much of it is half of it is really, I think, what the reader is bringing to their experience.
I suppose in that sense, then a book that's pretty universally admired taps into something that's common to most people. And so it's interesting if you look at authors' careers, say an author has 5 books or 20 books, there are usually 2 or 3 books in that author's career that stand out as being classic or as being admired by most people. And I think that presents a scenario that even though the reader is bringing a different experience to the table in the guise of each individual, there's something about that book that appeals to the majority of readers. I don't know where I'm going with that exactly, but, you know, it's something that we try to parse out a lot. I feel when I write that I'm compelled to tell the story that I'm telling and I can't tell any other story. Like, that's the one that sees me and drags me around by the hair. And I think that surprises other writers I talk to and sometimes readers who say, well, don't you sit down and consider your audience? Like, what does your audience want to read? Does your audience want to read a love story, a war story, a mother-daughter story, a brother-sister story? And that's really not something, with all due respect to my readers, that I think about when I'm first telling the story. I mean, it really has to be something that's compelling. But if you're lucky as a writer, what is compelling to you is universal to the reader, no matter what experience they bring. I mean, to like 90% of readers. And then there are 5% who say, I hate you and I hate this book. And then there are the other 5% who says, you know, I'm never going to read anything else in my life ever again. So, I mean, goodness, what a great profession we have. It's really psychologically interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, what we do is, you know, really, I guess with writing is we study people anyway and study interactions. Mm-hmm. And it's exactly what, you know, I don't think you can be necessarily a good writer without being a good observer and taking it all in and trying to understand why people act the way they do and with each other and what causes people to be the way they are. And so much of that is because of the experiences they've had in their life. And that obviously, you know, it runs through both of our stories in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So, you talk about somebody who loves your book so much. I do recall you posting a picture about someone who tattooed a quote from your book onto her body. So that's pure love.
That was amazing. I mean, I posted this on my Facebook page, and the reader was just a generous soul, obviously. I mean, like, super generous. So she had written to me beforehand to say, I hope this doesn't freak you out in any way, but I'm going to tattoo my favorite passage from your book on my shoulder blade. And do you mind if I post a picture of it? And I was like, no, are you crazy? That's just the most, I mean, I always think that a good writer's words get under my skin. I was like, my words are on your skin. That's just an incredible homage. And I think,
yeah.
I mean, that's just one, a fraction of things that I'm grateful for every day that readers
right.
do. I remember one of the first letters that I got about this, You Save Us, was from a girl in the fourth grade who wrote to me, and she had seen the cover and was interested in Holocaust literature, and could she read the book for her class? And, you know, I mean, just this, somebody wrote to me from, like, Poland the second day the book was in publication, and that was my first book, so I was like, somebody in Poland is reading my book, I don't know how many. Every day I hear from readers who take the time out of their busy lives not only to buy and read a book but to write to me what their reaction is, this floors me. So whether it's written on their skin or in an email or Facebook page, Twitter, it doesn't really matter. It's just every day I feel like I am exposed to this miracle, this sort of ongoing miracle of reader reactions. I'm really grateful.
Oh, I love that. And one of the best things ever is that, you know, I think friends of mine are so surprised when they realize what a community writers are, you know, have created, and the fact that so many of us are so supportive of each other, and it's so rare that I ever encounter a feeling of, you know, just a straight competition, instead of just, we can all win this together. There's room enough for all of us, and the better we all, you know, we all do, the better for all of us, and the better for books in general. So I think that's just one of the best perks ever, has been getting to know people like you and Sarah McCoy and all these people that we have in common now that I'm just so excited to finally meet in person in March.
I know, me too. I'm nodding, and I just realized you can't see that because we're on the radio. So, you know,
see, you're used to Skyping with your book clubs.
Yeah, exactly. I've got my Skype tiara on, you know, which doubles as Oscar's tiara. But, I bless social media for that. I'm not really sure that I had that sense before social media that writers were able to support each other so readily and to connect with each other. I went to grad school at Boston University for creative writing, and I was really lucky to have very supportive classmates, and we would get our stuff ripped apart regularly in class, and then we would all go to the same bar afterwards and talk about the magnitude of the ripping and buy drinks for the poor bleeding writer. But apparently for that program it was really unusual, and most of the people were very competitive, and we did have a competitive undertone and were encouraged, in fact, by our professors to compete with each other. So it was kind of like, if I were going to do a reality show about writers, it might actually be rather boring, but if I were going to do, and it would be based on this program. And I think that was the sort of prevailing attitude toward other writers that I picked up in those days. I couldn't even go to a bookstore when I was working on early drafts of Those Who Save Us and The Storm Chaser, because I would be grinding my teeth at night thinking, I have to get out there, and other people have their stuff out, and why isn't my stuff out there yet, and I have to do more and do it harder. And now you go on Facebook and you go on Twitter, and people are actively publicizing each other's books and saying good for you when a book comes out, and putting up the beautiful covers in advance so readers know what to look for, and really encouraging each other through the writing process too. I mean, if somebody goes on Twitter with a hashtag #mwriting and says, boy, I'm having a lousy day, my character just ran away with my scene, does that happen to anybody? That writer has a pocket community of other writers who can chorus in and say, you're not alone. And I just think that's such an incredible phenomenon. I mean, who needs competition? The world is hard enough, so we all should be helping each other.
Yeah, absolutely. So fabulous. Well, I guess we could easily keep talking all night long, but I guess we better wrap this up so this show can end, and then you and I can go watch our Oscars, and then we'll talk about that in March. So I will mention... I know, we got to go watch our Oscar parties. Wanted to also mention, besides us being at the Tucson Festival of Books, like Jenna had mentioned in the beginning, that we're doing a World War II book club party giveaway, and where all the four authors of us, including Ruta Sepetys, I hope I pronounced her name right, I adore Ruta, and who wrote Between Shades of Grey, which is an incredible book, and Sarah McCoy, who just released The Baker's Daughter, which is also phenomenal.
Awesome.
The four of us are doing, which we are just going to have an incredible party ourselves on our side, but we'll be Skyping in with a winning book club. And so I think probably the easiest thing to do is since we're going to plug both of our websites here, I'll say on my website, which is www.Christina with a K, Mick Morris, and it's mcmorris.com. If you go on my website and click on the news and events page, you'll see the contest and the link right there at the top with all four of our book covers, and which we call those our children, and they're having a play date together. It's kind of our running joke.
That's right. They're going to be rowdy children partying and cheer.
So, Jenna, why don't you tell them your website and before we go?
I shall. Thank you. And I do definitely want to thank all the readers who are listening and all the writers who are listening and all the book clubs who are listening. And book clubs, you have a day left to enter this contest. And if you win the contest, you get to come to our rowdy Skype book club party. And we are going to have World War II costumes on, which I have yet to buy. And there's a prize involved. You get this mystery package that all of the writers put together and contributed to. I don't even know what's in my fellow writers' contributions to this package, so I'm really curious. But please go to Chris's website. You can go to my Facebook page. I'm Jenna Blum on Facebook, as I am elsewhere in the world. And my website is www.jennablum.com, JennaBlum.com. And I doubt I'm as organized as Chris is, but I definitely have the contest posted on that website. And so I hope that you all keep in touch with me and keep in touch with Chris and try to win our contest and come and Skype party with us and talk books with us and come see us in Tucson and come see us online. We welcome all readers, always.
That sounds great. Thank you so much, Jenna. Yeah. It was so nice chatting with you.
It was so great chatting with you. I can't wait to meet you in person and give you a big hug and congratulations on the release of Bridge of Scarlet Leaves, which, again, people, is really awesome. If you're a World War II reader or just a good story, you should buy it immediately.
Thank you. Thank you. I will see you in just a couple of weeks, sweetheart.
Yay. I'm very happy. enjoy your launch with your awesome novel.
Oh, thank you. You have a good night.
Thanks, you too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Informant, you know, say that I'm a stormy, I'm a glam. I keep on bum bam. Take the man that says that I'm a stormy, I'm somewhat out of land. I keep on bum bam. Informant, you know, say that I'm a stormy, I'm a glam. I keep on bum bam. Take the man that says that I'm a stormy, I'm somewhat out of land. I keep on bum bam. These are the men who come in and they blow down my door. Rainy car part through my window, so they put me in the back of the car at the station. From that point, I'm a reach my destination. Where the destination reaching out of easy tension. Where I'm look down my pants, look up my bottom. So informer, you know, say that I'm a snowman, I go glam. I like it, boom, boom, damn. Take the man that say that I'm a snowman, stop somewhere down the lane. I like it, boom, boom, damn. Informer, you know, say that I'm a snowman, I go glam. I like it, boom, boom, damn. Take the man that say that I'm a snowman, stop somewhere down the lane. Keep on bum bam, so big on the mind, they think they have more power. They find a poem, if they did find a worm, if it was a user once, and now me call me lover. Lover will be calling on the one, tell me, I'm in love in my heart, down to my belly. Yes, and I'm a stomach, I'll be cool and deadly. It's the one MC Shan and the one that is low. Together we all have them, it's a tornado. Informer, you know, say that I'm a stomach, I'm a glam. I keep on bum bam, take the man that says that I'm a stomach, start somewhere down the lane. I keep on bum bam, informer. You know, say that I'm a stormy, I go glam. I keep on bum bam. Take the man that says that I'm a stormy, start somewhere down the lane.
boom, boom, damn. So listen for me, you better listen for me now. Listen for me, you better listen for me now. Bring me the world with the light, for the form of the rock and stay. It's it and I'm a stormy, yeah, the art to cut on. But in the inner, I'm the dance, I miss the way I come from. People them say you come from Jamaica, but me born and raised in Connecticut, don't know what else you know. Few brown people, man, is all I'm on, no. Yeah, my shoes and them say up and I'm a toes, it's a show. For me, you're born and all the ones you're on, so, so inform. You know, say that I'm a stormy, I go glam. I lick it, boom, boom, damn. Take them on the face, say that I'm a stormy, start stumble down the lane. I lick it, boom, boom, damn. Informer. You know, say that I'm a stormy, I go glam. I lick it, boom, boom, damn. Take them on the face, say that I'm a stormy, start stumble down the lane. I lick it, boom, boom, damn. Come with a nice young lady. Intelligent, yes, she juggling Ari. Everywhere me go, me never left for a tally. You say that it's stormy, I the rum dance man. Rum is in a dance, I lean in a nation. You never know, say that I'm a stormy, I the boom shaka. Tell me never lay it down flat, and now I'm can't go down flat. You say that I'm a stormy, I go region at a drop. So informer, you know, say that I'm a stormy, I go glam. I lick it, boom, boom, damn. Take them on the street, say that I'm a stormy, start to tumble down the lane. I lick it, boom, boom, damn. Informer, you know, say that I'm a stormy, I go glam. I lick it, boom, boom, damn. Take them on the street, say that I'm a stormy, start to tumble down the lane. I lick it, boom, boom, damn. Why
would? Why would? Why would? Sitting around cool with my dibby dibby girl. Police knock my door, lick up my pal. Rough me up and I can't do a thing. Pick up my line when my telephone rings. Take me to the station, black up my hand. Trail me down cause I'm hanging with the snowman. What I'm gonna do? I'm backed in a trap. Slap me in the face and took all of my gas. They have no clues and they wanna get warmer. But Sham won't turn informer.
Informer, you know, say that I'm a stormy, I go glam. I lick it, boom, boom, damn. Take them on the street, say that I'm a stormy, start to tumble down the lane. I lick it, boom, boom, damn. Informer, you know, say that I'm a stormy, I go glam. I lick it, boom, boom, damn. Take them on the street, say that I'm a stormy, start to tumble down the lane. I lick it, boom, boom, damn.